Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, where we are exploring the different chasms of consciousness and reality and how those two things kind of interplay with each other. Eric Davis will not be joining us today. Me, Majidawu, will be the host today. And today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, which is magic. I spend a lot of time thinking about magic and reading about it and all its different ways and kind of formulations. But today, specifically, we're going to be talking about chaos magic, which is a very kind of newfangled, futuristic kind of magic, some people think. And I'll admit, the first time that I heard about chaos magic, I thought it was like some dorky Dungeons and Dragons, maybe kind of faction that came out of Warhammer. And I was a little bit biased towards it. But then when I actually started looking at the material, I found out that it was, in fact, this very innovative, new, fresh way of integrating a lot of modern techniques into this very ancient art form of magic. And we're very lucky today to have someone who's written a great deal about some of those exciting innovations. His name is Phil Farber, and he has written books such as Meta Magic, The Book of Atem, Achieving New States of Consciousness. And also, he's written a couple novels. I think one of them was called The Great Purple Hoo-Ha. Phil, we're so glad that you're here joining us today. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Of course. I'm very glad to be talking to you because, like I said, I read a lot about magic, and I think more people need to know about chaos magic and kind of what it's all about. Can you give us like a quick and dirty kind of explanation of what chaos magic is and how it's kind of different from other schools of magic?
Well, I don't want to disappoint you too much, but I don't really define myself as a chaos magician. That kind of really, to my mind, comes out of, I think other people tend to define me that way, but the chaos magic really comes out of a tradition of Peter Carroll and Phil Hine and people who were working with them several decades ago. And but I think what I do comes out of similar roots. I think one of the widest definitions of chaos magic is freestyle magic or postmodern magic or freestyle shamanism. And by that broad definition, I guess what I do kind of fits into there. What I'm really more interested in at this point is looking at some of the advances that we've had in recent years in things like linguistics and neurolinguistics and neuroscience, and using those tools to understand what happens when people are practicing magic. And by doing that, it kind of gives us some clue how to actually make magic replicable and maybe more effective. So that's kind of where the direction I'm coming from. I think that's compatible with a lot of what people who are involved in specifically or self-identified as chaos magic come into also. And there's some similar roots. Some of the work Robert Anton Wilson and Discordianism and things like that often come into play.
Well, that's so you're like more niche in that terms of that you focus more on like the linguistic aspect then.
Well, what I've really worked at, my interest in magic came, I don't know, in the early 80s, I guess. And around that same time, I had been beginning to study neurolinguistic programming, which is really a set of tools. It's more, people think of it as these techniques for causing these changes in your life. But really what it is, it's a terminology and a set of tools for understanding how we process our language and our thoughts. And my first thought was immediately, oh, you know, if you can use this to understand all these other kinds of behaviors, why not magic? And so that's what I really started doing, and that's where my material kind of developed from. And there are other people who are identified as chaos magicians, excuse me, who also have been working with NLP as well, including people like Dave Lee and Andre Vitamus and folks like that.
Right. Well, to me, that's very fascinating because if you look into the history of magic, you see it's inextricably bound with specifically the written word and language. I mean, all of those terms, like invocation, you know, is like speaking words and kind of different combinations of letters is really like the heart of magic. Even certainly with Kabbalistic magic, it's all just like programs of strings of letters. And like even like the spell, like the word spell is related to spelling, like spelling words. So to me, like magic really at its heart is about language and speaking and writing and all that kind of stuff. So I'm really fascinated in the fact that you're connecting that into like NLP in a kind of programming way.
Yeah, we do. I mean, traditional magic was always about the relation between our consciousness and the world. And the way that we express that certainly is through language. And,
right.
You know, as well as in language, we could broaden that and say it's really communication. I mean, because we communicate also through images and sounds, you know, music and pictures and you know, tonalities and all kinds of things. And but those also kind of play into, they have a syntax and a grammar the same way that language does. And in a sense, we can kind of track the way our consciousness processes information and processes the world around us through that kind of syntax and grammar. And there are things that are presupposed in the syntax and grammar, most notably in our language, things about our relationship with time and the way that, and matter and space and things like that, that are very, very fundamental. And when we start to get in there and we can start to kind of tweak those a little bit, then our world starts to change, or our relationship to our world starts to change.
So it's interesting you say, like, our relationship. So do you think, like, through these kind of NLP and stuff like that, that you can not only kind of track your own consciousness, but actually have a measurable effect on the material world around you? Or is it just, like, more like how you interact with it?
Well, it's both. I mean, we're always having some effect on the world around us. You can't not affect the world around you.
Right.
Your very presence at this moment, sitting wherever you are, you're breathing, you're inhaling oxygen, you're exhaling carbon dioxide. You're interacting with the world, and you're having an effect on it. Any small change that you make in that system has ramifications. It has changes in the entire system. They might be very minute, or they might be very large. And when you change the way that you process the way that you think, when you change your consciousness, when you change your state, you're actually, in some at least small measure, changing your influence on the world around you. Now, I don't necessarily think that we can suddenly, you know, like the fictional or television version of magic where, you know, you concentrate and a vein bulges on your forehead and then something levitates off the ground. you know, maybe that's possible somehow. I haven't quite figured that one out yet. But because there's a whole, your consciousness is really, it's a world that you've created inside your mind, the reflection of the world outside, which is a complete system, and everything kind of has to fit in its place. It all works together. So to change the one part of the world that says, you know, all right, things can levitate, you've got to change everything around you that already says it can't. You know,
right.
All of the everything you're looking at this moment is sticking to the floor or the surface of your desk or whatever, and you know, somehow you would have to change some basic presupposition on a level that would change the entire world to be able to do that.
So would you say then that in your definition, magic would not include the kind of miraculous events, like, say, you know, the yoga, siddha traditions of people like flying or things like, or levitation. So you would say that you do not agree that that is something achievable by, like, programming NLP methods?
Well, I put that in the I don't know category. although I've been in some ritual situations where some pretty strange things have happened. And, you know, this is going back, I don't know, 25 years or something, where a group of us were doing ritual, and some objects apparently, like, got up by themselves and moved across the room, and we all looked at each other and said, you know, did you see that? And we all reported pretty much the same thing. You know, so there's a lot of weirdness in the world that we don't quite understand. And when you change your consciousness in a way that those basic presuppositions change, maybe the world will suddenly seem very normal, right? I mean, it would be that you've recognized that something is possible in the world that seems to be the one that's already existing, although maybe it's changed. It's hard to say, because that's how your conscious mind is processing things.
Well, and it seems like when you start getting into altering your consciousness, I mean, that your perceptions increase and you see things that maybe otherwise would have seemed impossible, that maybe people don't notice, like miraculous things or things like that. And I was just asking because those seem to be affiliated with magic and sorcery and all that kind of stuff through tradition. But I was just curious kind of like what your opinion was about how deep the manipulation on the material level can go when you get into practicing magic. Like, does it go to changing the weather and causing rain and, like, actually physically altering these things that would otherwise seem out of our level of reach of control as human beings, or is it more like just about controlling your individual self?
Well, I think it's all of the above. I have been involved in and have witnessed rituals that did, in fact, appear to change the weather. Most summers I attend, there's a festival that was formerly in New York State. It just recently moved to Ohio, called the Starwood Festival. And there's always great ritual events there. And some years the New Orleans Voodoo Temple comes there. And one year it just rained the whole time. There were two moments when it stopped raining for the whole week. And one was I was doing a workshop, and we decided to do a little experiment and invoke the sun. And as we did that, right at the climax of our ritual, the clouds parted and the sun peered forth, and it was great. The other moment was when the New Orleans Voodoo Temple was doing their ritual, and it was raining, and they did a little ritual calling on Papa Legba and Mama Wata to open the clouds, to part the clouds, and right on cue, this is at night, the clouds parted and the stars shone through and held off till the end of the ritual, and then the rain came back. And so synchronicity, coincidence, becoming, do the rituals, is there a cause and effect, or are we just suddenly synchronizing ourselves to events that are already happening? It's very difficult to tell, but very fun to play around with.
Well, and that's the most fascinating part of magic to me, almost, because then it's like your consciousness is connected to, like, the world on a larger level, like to the point of connected to the clouds and, like, the sun and, you know, all these things that people usually see as apart from themselves. And that when you can change your consciousness to that level, you're literally, like, kind of unified with these things instead of separated from them. And, I mean, to me, that's, like, the whole thing with magic is kind of about connecting yourself to perceiving the connection between things.
Oh, absolutely. And if you think about traditional magic, a lot of it was very concerned with celebrating the seasons, and rituals were held on the equinoxes and the solstices and other important points of the calendar.
Right.
And as well, a lot of the traditional rituals are very concerned with orientation in space, with the cardinal points of the compass and so on. And so in one sense, those rituals are very much about aligning yourself with the world and with the way things are. And when you're able to do that, you find that suddenly you seem to have a lot more influence on what's going on around you.
Mm.
And it's not as simple as you know, some of these, like The Secret or things like that, where, you know, they say, well, if you just have a positive attitude, or you think about having lots of money or something, then it's going to appear. It's certainly not as simple as that. These are what I consider fairly complex phenomena, because we're talking about systems that operate, you know, on the level of fractal chaos and, you know, on a level of great complexity. And once we start to understand them and start to understand our place in them and the influence that we have, then you start to understand the ways that you can influence them. And it's not necessarily just by wishing for something. It's by knowing how to change your consciousness in a particular way.
Hmm. And now you mentioned chaos theory. How much do you integrate that into your kind of worldview of it? I know you said you don't consider yourself a chaos magician, but you've obviously read a little bit about chaos theory. And how do you think that applies to how you view magical working?
Well, I do tend to think of things in terms of systems, and and I'm not I'm not by any means a mathematician, so I don't really I'm not able to compute the math on the level that a mathematician would do this kind of stuff. But I do I have read layman's works on the concepts. And I do think it does come into play. I mean, everyone's familiar with the butterfly's wing theory,
right,
where, you know, some minute something happens somewhere, the butterfly beats his wing somewhere, and it causes a storm on the other side of the world. I do believe we have our systems are like that. However, I also think that by knowing, and this is probably coming close to a definition of magic, is that by knowing just where to beat the butterfly's wing and at what time, then you know how to produce specific things at specific times. In one of in neurolinguistic programming, one of the original ideas, one of the early books about it, talked about critical point analysis, where the story of the ship has an engine that everybody's been trying to fix. It hasn't worked, you know, forever, and everybody's in there tinkering around, and they hear about some guy who says, he's the best guy in the world. He knows how to fix it. He comes in, and he looks at the engine, and he takes a wrench, and gives it a whack on the side, and the engine starts right up. And then he hands them the bill for $1 million, and they go, what, $1 million? You know, all you did was tap it with a wrench. He says, yeah, but I knew exactly where to tap it.
Right.
You know, so in a sense, it's, we have that relationship with the world. And, you can think about that. It's obvious in terms of things like our computers and business and things like that. If you put the right command in your computer at the right time, it's going to do something. It's going to do the right thing.
You know? Right.
In business, if you make your investment with the right amount on the right stock at the right time or so on, then you're going to get the right yield. The world works like that in a lot of ways. If you're going to think the right thought or say the right word or whatever at the right time, it also it's going to have a specific effect. Also, in neuroscience, we're finding that humans aren't really. We have this little spot in our brain, in the right parietal lobe of the brain, that tells us that we're individual humans, that says, I am me. Mm-hmm. However, for the most part, humans are a hive mind. We're constantly sharing information on an unconscious level through what's called our mirror neuron system and through unconscious behaviors, facial expressions, subtle movements of the body, the way you breathe, and so on. And we're always affecting each other. And there's this constant flow of information. And when somebody says something and somebody else hears it, it has an effect that propagates through the entire system of humans.
Right.
So you also see that kind of effect with human beings as well as mortal things.
Right, and that all goes into like the influence side of magic, right? Like that whole concept of sway and how we can hold sway together. It's kind of like that monkey see, monkey do thing where I was reading this thing about how people, like if they're watching a fight, that's why I break out at fights, because people are watching that behavior and then they mimic it. Or like if they're watching football and they'll like unconsciously, when it's like taking it to kickoff, and they literally like mirror those actions. And he was looking at how like just watching someone do things influences this deep part of your brain where we hold such sway over each other. And I think it's because of that hive mind kind of effect that we can hold such influence over each other. And sometimes like that's that whole hypnotism idea, right, where the magician as being able to hypnotize people kind of comes from.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The parts of our brain, it's known as the mirror neuron system. In effect, these are motor neurons that also respond when we watch another person do something. So we do. I mean, it's the basic reason why we watch sports or we watch television or movies or something. When you see Luke Skywalker blast the Death Star out of the sky at the end of the first Star Wars movie, you get this thrill in you like you did it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Or on a more prosaic level, it's why yawns are contagious, right? If you're sitting with a group of friends and someone yawns, and then the next person yawns, and so on.
Right.
So we're sharing information on that level. There's also the ability to influence people directly that way, and we do it, and this has been used and misused throughout human history. I mean, you only have to think, somebody like Hitler or something like that,
right,
where they're really using mirror neurons on a mass scale, using that hive mind effect to get people to do absolutely heinous things.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's, a concept in many mystical-based religions this information that's imparted by the teacher or the guru without words. Only in the presence of the guru do you pick up this kind of information. And when you think about it in terms of these kinds of neuroscience ideas that we're starting to learn, there's some basis for it. I mean, in the presence of somebody who is in a very altered state of consciousness, you're going to pick some of that up if they're very congruent with it and very strong with that particular state. So,
well, it's true, and there's anthropologists that have looked at shamans that go into an ecstatic state, like as a performance, and then audience members will spontaneously go into ecstatic states, like almost through a kind of contagious, sympathetic magic, where just having the person in front of you be in an altered state, it changes your consciousness as well.
Oh, absolutely. As a practicing hypnotist, I sometimes get to do demonstrations in front of groups, and what's really, really fun is that you take a subject and you bring them up on stage and you put them into a trance and you have them do some trance phenomena, and then you can turn and look at the audience and see that a large percentage of the audience is exhibiting the exact same trance phenomena.
Wow.
And it's a very common phenomena. Hypnotists use this, all the time. Milton Erickson, who was one of the greatest hypnotists of the 20th century, was once asked, you know, when you put somebody into a trance, do you also go into trance? And he says, well, I go into trance first, and I take them with me. And,
oh, interesting.
And there's wonderful films of Erickson doing trance inductions, and he would get, there's one, you could probably find it online somewhere or on eBay or something, called the Mondi video, where he has a subject named Mondi, who's one of his regular subjects, who he had worked with quite a bit. And then he has some other, this young man who had never been hypnotized before and was a little nervous about doing it and didn't really want to, you know, was kind of ambivalent about it. So he says, well, you sit and watch. And he puts Mondi into a deep trance, and then the camera pans back to this other guy, and he's also obviously just, you know, drifting off into the trance as well.
Wow.
So, you know, it's fun, and it's a fairly common phenomenon. You could observe this on, you know, on the subway or, you know, on a bus or something like that, just watching in an elevator, watching how when one person goes into a kind of trance, everybody else sort of follows.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, like, our capacity to do that. I mean, that's literally, like you said, like how Hitler and kind of propaganda and all that mind control kind of seems to be the mechanism for its capacity to operate, is that we have that ingrained in our brains, literally on a, you know, like, neurological level. So when that happens, we just kind of fall privy to it. Now, do you think that the magician who concentrates on their own consciousness, do you think that they're able to escape those kind of influences?
I don't know about entirely escape, but by being able to control your own state of consciousness at any given time, you can make the decision to be in a particular state, to change your state. You know, Robert Anton Wilson used to say, you know, we're always in some kind of trance. The trick is deciding which trance you're going to be in. So, you know, we're always in, you know, that's sort of one of the key things of NLP or hypnosis or many kinds of magic. I mean, we're taught, one of the first things that a magician is taught in traditional kinds of magic is a banishing ritual. Typically the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram. And what's that for? It's for changing your state. It's for making a delineation and saying, all right, this is the point where I'm going to stop being in the state I was in, and then I can choose to do an invocation or something and go into whatever state I want to be in. So that's a big part of it. And when we start to understand, I mean, we started out talking about, you know, is this all just about changing your own consciousness, or is it about changing the world? And at some point, when you start to understand how interconnected we all are and how connected we are to the world around us, there really isn't a difference in that. When you start to change your own state of consciousness, you're already changing the world.
And that's like, you know, that Gandhi quote, of course, where he would say, be the change you want to see. And it is, it's like, if you want the world to be different, I mean, this is like that whole hokey sort of new age thing, but it's true, where when you are responsible for changing your own consciousness, it's almost like spreads like a virus, because like you said, being in the presence of a guru whose consciousness has changed, that affects people by contagion.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you start to understand that the mirror neuron system, this network of unconscious information that's flowing between us, is one of the bases of mimetics. I mean, it's really how information spreads from one person to another. I mean, somebody could have a great idea, but unless they're also kind of sharing a little bit of state with it, a little bit of state of consciousness along with it, other people don't pick it up. It's not appealing unless there's some kind of state change or something that goes along with it. And this system, it allows us to share information with each other on a conscious level, and also to put our own influence on the world in all kinds of ways.
Well, all right, that's the music. We're going to take a little break. We'll hear some messages from the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello! Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me, and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Progressives, this is Betsy Rosenberg on the Green Front. I hope you've been enjoying the news I'm bringing you hot off the press, so to speak, like behind-the-scenes stories and insider scoop from Al Gore's recent climate conference. I know the Greenistas and love introducing the most informative and inspiring experts on the Green Front every week. So join me as we learn more about our environment and what we can do to turn it around.
The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, every Wednesday at 2 on the Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here talking with Phil Farber about magic. Hooray! So we talked a little bit about NLP, and I was wondering do you talk about any specific techniques of NLP that you use for magic in your book? Like, do you break it down for people on, like, what exact techniques will get results?
Absolutely, and what I've done particularly in the MetaMagic book is I've really taken, and I have a forthcoming book that's going to be out in October called Brain Magic. In both of them, I've used NLP techniques to kind of dissect the small behaviors behind evocation in the MetaMagic book and invocation in the Brain Magic book. Hmm. And by doing that, you can kind of... What I do is I sort of use the techniques to extract the process of the ritual without the traditional content, so that people can use as the content in the ritual, they can use their own experiences, their own memories, their own emotions, and so on, and actually begin to relate to these and create them as entities and gods and goddesses and so on. And some of it begins with just really basic kind of NLP ideas, and the way we use our senses and so on, and then kind of builds it up. Both of the books, really, they start with the real simple stuff and then kind of build it up into, ultimately, you get into rituals that are as complex, if not more complex, than some of the traditional stuff.
So these rituals have physical counterparts where you actually do actions, or are they mostly like meditative and conscious?
They could be done either way. I do recommend, for the most part, that people do incorporate movement into the rituals, and get up and move around and so on, because, again, we're talking about the states of consciousness, and they're closely associated with your motor neurons. And again, in the mirror neuron system is also, these are all motor neurons that respond in different ways. So when we're changing state, you put it into your body, really, by incorporating some movement into what you're doing. But, of course, if you can't, you know, you're in a situation where you can't, you can also do these in your head. I mean, even in traditional magic, Aleister Crowley once conducted an experiment where he was doing his holy guardian angel invocation while riding a bus across London. Just to see if he could do it. You can do it both ways. I do recommend at least to start with that you use the physical components as well, because that way when you later do it in your mind, you're recalling the actual physical sensations that are involved.
Well, it's true. You get like a muscle memory, and that's like kind of yoga, right, would be a good example of that. But I think it's interesting because I'm a big fan of like Thich Nhat Hanh, who does like walking meditation, and just that idea that you can do meditation and these kind of techniques everywhere you go, like doing everything, like washing the dishes can be an opportunity to use ritual. And like in Hasidic Judaism too, right, they infiltrate ritual into every action, whether it's from going to the bathroom, to tying your shoe, to doing all these things. And that's what I like about NLP, is that you can do it in all these simple, mundane actions that you do every day. You don't have to like be sitting in quiet somewhere, you know, just concentrating. You can actually put it into your physical life.
Well, absolutely. And I think that ultimately what we're talking about is we're talking about transforming our lives. And in effect, people, I think it's a mistake that people make in saying that magic only happens in the consecrated circle in the temple or something like that. Those rituals are there to learn about these experiences, to learn about the states, but then they don't mean anything unless you bring them back into your life.
Right.
And at some point, you start to notice the sacredness of everything that you do, the importance of everything that you do, and the importance of your state of consciousness and the way that you relate to the world in absolutely everything that you do. And, again, yes, you know, washing the dishes or, driving your car or something like that, if these are conscious acts, it makes a very difference, a very big difference in your life than just kind of going through them, you know, automatically while you're wishing you're someplace else.
Right.
You know, so...
And I love that you gave the Crowley example, too, and I think it's important. And actually, that's like a whole other thing I could ask you, too, is... Crowley gets this bad rep for a lot of his physical actions that he tied into his magical acts and practices. But in fact, he was doing just that. He was trying to integrate his magical practices into his life and the things he was doing in his life, whether it was drug use or sex or riding a bus or all those things. He was infiltrating his conscious practices on that level of his everyday actions, no matter what they were. Even if there were things like maybe some people might judge as bad things, he was still infiltrating his conscious and magic into every single act, and not just something as good as and sacred as going to temple, but even the things that might be thought of as shameful as well. So he was like even integrating his shadow things into it.
Yes, I do think so. Again, some of the things that during his day were thought of as very bad nowadays are kind of ho-hum.
I mean,
he had sex, he was bisexual, he used drugs, so nowadays you go like, well, you know, so do most of our celebrities, you know,
yeah.
Whatever. you know, he would be, in terms of gossip fodder, he'd be a lot lower on the shelf now than, you know, Lady Gaga or, you know, whatever. But yes, that's really what he was doing. And his whole idea that, you know, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law was that the things that you do in your life, and the way that you set up your whole life towards, in his terms, your true will, transforms your life. And it's not just about going into the temple and meditating on what your true will is and calling forth your angel, and then suddenly your life is transformed. It's not. It's about doing it. Coming back out of the circle and actually, like, making it happen in the world.
Well, and how do you think that the NLP techniques, do you think those infiltrate on that level, like, to the level of your consciousness where you start thinking, or have you found for you that you start thinking about those techniques when you are just, like, kind of whatever, doing these random everyday activities?
Well, the fun thing about the NLP techniques is that you can set it up in advance. It's called anchoring. You can anchor different processes and states and experiences to different situations in your life, so that when you get into a situation, let's see, during one NLP training session that we did here some years ago, there's a technique where you people mostly use it for habit change. They get into a situation, let's say a smoker wants to stop smoking. They use as a cue the situation where they're about to reach for a cigarette, and then suddenly the anchor kicks in, and they're in a state where they feel great and they don't need it. They just want to breathe fresh air and go out and look at the sky or something. But I asked the group to think of some situations and things that they wanted to do, and this one woman came up with this really positive one. She said, "Well, when I get up in the morning and I see my kids, I want to feel really great about them and remember and, you know, realize all the love that I have for them." I was like, that is incredible. And she did this. And so she set this up as an anchor so that when she saw her kids' faces in the morning when she got up, I don't know, maybe she had a history of being cranky and, you know, before she had her coffee or something, I don't know. But she came back the next day and over the next few days and reported that, yeah, she got up in the morning and she saw her kids' faces and just felt this wave of love come over her, and, you know, her relationship with her kids improved and so on. So that's one of the fun things about NLP, is that you can kind of set these things up to happen in different circumstances. And that's a nice piece to add into magic, where you're creating these really powerful and incredible and consciousness sweeping states of consciousness, where you can set up these anchors using the NLP techniques to incorporate them into different parts of your life.
Well, it's so interesting, just that idea that it's like a program that you can install into your brain, like, you know, kind of like in the Matrix, where you just, like, download how to do kung fu, that you can, like, program your mind to have certain reactions, just like your body, trained martial arts, will have a reaction to fight. Your brain can have a reaction based on a trigger. And I was wondering, like, if you've read much of, you know, like, certainly Timothy Leary's 8-circuit brain model, or like John Lilly's, like, metaprogramming the human biocomputer, and how you think those kind of things relate, if they're similar.
Oh, sure. And actually, in his later years, Leary became very interested in NLP. And he worked a little bit with Robert Diltz, who's an NLP, one of the original NLP guys, who's in Santa Cruz. I do think, and actually a lot of NLP people are kind of interested in using the 8-circuit model and so on, and being able to access those states and to anchor them into different circumstances, and to use some of the NLP state changing techniques to explore some of those. Also Robert Anton Wilson, who wrote quite a bit of Prometheus Rising, is essentially about the 8-circuit model. He also later became very interested in NLP and became good friends with Richard Bandler, who's the founder of NLP. And actually, they used to they did a series of appearances together where Bob Wilson would do his you know, he'd get up and do his thing, whatever he was into at the time, and then the NLP students would all would work on modeling his behavior in his states and learning to get into the states that he was in when he was doing his whatever it was.
Huh, very much like a guru kind of, huh?
Yeah, sure. But very conscious about it, where they would kind of break it down, observe his physiology and his his language and so on, and use those as cues to kind of access some of the experiences that he was having. Interesting stuff.
And how accessible would you say some of these techniques are in your book? Are they like really complicated and rigorous, or can most people kind of accomplish them?
Well, like I said, they all start out with the smallest little chunks of behavior. So, mm-hmm. So they're designed so that anybody could pick them up and start working them, whether you have a background in NLP or not, whether you have a background in magic or not. You could pick these up and you could start working right from scratch. And hopefully along the way pick up some of the general principles of both magic and NLP.
Mm-hmm.
So especially the Meta Magic book, I think you can you could pick that up and really just start right away, because it uses, traditional magic, you had to memorize all of these complex systems, the correspondences of Kabbalah.
Complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated stuff, and you had to memorize a whole lot of stuff before you could start working.
Right.
And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with that. Those are great systems, and that's the way I started learning magic. But there's other ways to do it, too. We all have – our consciousness is a reflection of the universe at large, so we all have this whole holistic range of experiences just from living as long as we have. However many years we've been on the planet, we all have a whole world inside of us, and we can start pulling from that and using the different pieces – of that, the same way that a traditional magician might use Kabbalah or so on. The advantage is that you don't have to have all this stuff pre-memorized, because it's already your memories. It's already your life.
Right. Can you remember a particular book that kind of started you on your path, or was it more like broad, or was there like a specific thing that really just triggered you?
Well, there was a whole lot of... a whole lot of stuff. I started studying hypnosis when I was a child, largely because my father, who was a physicist, he worked his way through college as a stage magician, and he had a hypnosis routine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he had a hypnosis routine that he used. And so we had this whole stack of hypnosis books on the shelves when I was a kid, and I was a voracious reader, so I read everything in the house, including the whole encyclopedia from end to end by the time I was like 10 years old.
Wow.
So that included the hypnosis books, and I thought they were really cool, and I really wanted to play with that, a lot more. When I was a little bit older, when I was in college, my goal in life was always to be a writer and to write fiction and so on. And I kind of wanted, like, what are the keys to great language, to doing that? And I studied in college. I studied psychology of language and linguistics and things like that, and never really came across them. And then I found in the school library there was one of the early NLP books, and I read that. I was like, wow, this is what I was looking for. This just breaks it down in a way that you can actually use it. And
right.
Not only that, but it wasn't as boring as all the textbooks that were supposed to telling you about language, but not really using it in any kind of effective way. So,
right. I love Noam Chomsky, but trying to get through one of his language books is very tedious.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were, the early NLP stuff was actually based on Chomsky's transformational grammar and so on, but they were presenting
right.
it in a way that you could suddenly use it. It was practical. So, That just struck me as fun stuff, and I could read it, and I could start playing with my friends with this stuff like right away, and that was the fun. So that's what got me into that. I think I got into magic through reading Crowley and Robert Anton Wilson and so on, back in those days. So.
And did you ever pick up any, like, prestidigitation stuff from your dad, or was that more like a separate thing?
Well, I actually did. I learned when I was a kid. I learned some sleight of hand and so on. I haven't practiced any of that in so long. I doubt I could do that today. But yeah, when I was a kid, I did learn a little bit of sleight of hand and just some tricks and stuff like that. And I would, you know, play little pranks on my friends and things. But I doubt you really did the sleight of hand stuff. You really have to practice that stuff just to keep your fingers nimble enough to do it. I doubt it. It's been so long. I doubt I could do that these days.
And what does your dad think about your kind of magic stuff? Is he into it, or does he have trouble?
Well, he passed away some years ago, but towards the end of his life, at some one point he was, when I first started getting into this stuff, he was like, you know, what? but later on he had a coworker who was a Wiccan, and she looked at some of the things that I was doing and she started to explain it to him, and he started to accept it then, and actually towards the end of his life he was very encouraging about.
Wait, so was she a female Wiccan physicist?
I think she was a computer scientist of some kind.
Oh, okay. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, but you know what? It's actually interesting. People, there's this general idea that people who are Wiccans and magicians and so on are, you know, who knows what they do in their professions there, whatever. But in my experience in teaching magic classes and going to these conventions and stuff, I meet a hell of a lot of scientists and physicists and doctors and biochemists and so I don't really think that's not very odd. An awful lot of the people I meet in the field of magic are scientists. And also, if you think about Crowley, he studied chemistry when he was in college, and one of his mottos was the method of science.
Well, I love it because, you know, I studied biochemistry too, and like I mean physics comes from these crazy magicians, like the alchemists. All science comes from, you know, all the crazy alchemists and all that kind of stuff. Like Isaac Newton practiced all that stuff. So I love hearing where these worlds intersect. Like a physicist, that's a magician, like a performance magician, has a son that ends up becoming, like, you know, a figurehead in the magic community. That's like one of my favorite things in the world. So I love to see those connections and how they intersect.
Yeah, it's fun. I think I grew up basically as a scientist. I think both of my parents were working scientists. My mother was a biologist, a microbiologist.
Oh, really?
And so I mean, I grew up with a strong scientific background, and that's still sort of the foundation of the way I think about magic. When I got into it, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to test this stuff out. It's like, well, can we bring it into the laboratory? Can we, you know, how do we learn more about it?
Well, and it's another, like, chaos magic. That's one of the reasons I like it, even though, you know, you don't want to use that word, but they're using the scientific theory and integrating it into something which scientists, of course, would probably scoff at. Even the chaos scientists that develop those theories that are being used by these magicians would probably disagree with the way they're being used. But the fact is, they do intersect. And they do apply to each other, and you can use them scientifically to look at magic, and it works.
Yeah, and I do think that there's a big movement, particularly among the chaos magicians, to be more scientific about it, to really find ways to test your results and so on. So it's not there is this problem in some of the more traditional magical things where people kind of tend to delude themselves a little bit about what they're really doing with the magic. But
right.
there is really kind of a movement going on now for people to think about how to pose things as experiments and so on. I recently taught an online class for maybe Logic Academy, which magical experiments, where what we did was we took some of these magical ideas and as a group, we figured out how to pose them as experiments and to perform them, and we got some really interesting results. It was pretty neat.
Wow.
Probably do some of that again as well.
That does sound neat. Yeah, I just love that. Well, we're coming up towards the end of the program, and I was wondering if you could tell people if you have, like, a website or places they can get news about your new book and stuff like that.
Sure. The main place to go would be metamagic.com, M-E-T-A hyphen magic with a K, M-A-G-I-C-K.com, metamagic.com. And there's you can find out about the existing books. My two most recent ones were the Metamagic book, nonfiction, and the novel, The Great Purple Hoo-Ha, which is a magical novel, and you'll learn some stuff about magic reading it. Hopefully you'll laugh more. I've got some.
And do you have any classes or like events coming up?
Sure. I've got a bunch of events coming into the season here. So the next one coming up is going to be an online live workshop in Second Life, in the 3D environment of Second Life, called Language, Metaphor, and the Brain. That's going to be on February 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the website, you can find out about how to sign up for that, and there's some more information about it. In March, I've got a two-day event in Hawaii, which is going to be fun. In mid-April, I'll be in Seattle with chaos magician Andre Vitimus.
Oh, great.
Event called Make Magic 2011, which should be a lot of fun. And then in the end of April and early May, I'll be teaching some NLP here in upstate New York.
So do you teach that for the public, or is it for like a university setting?
It's for the public. Anybody who wants to, we have our own seminar space here. So if people want to come and sign up for that, then come in. It's a practitioner training course that's under the Society of NLP, which is Richard Bandler's organization. We do provide certification under them and so on.
That's great. And is there one of your books in particular that you think folks would get the most of these kind of techniques from? Would it be the MetaMagic book?
At this point, yes, the MetaMagic book would probably be the first place to look. Like I said, coming out in October will be Brain Magic, and I think they're kind of companion books. One is about evocation, one is about invocation, lots of good little tidbits about mimetics and neuroscience and how it all works into magic.
So the new book will have a lot of those techniques and explanations for folks to look into as well?
Yes, it will.
Oh, that's super. Well, thanks so much for being on the show today, Phil. I had a fantastic time talking. I'm sorry Eric couldn't make it. I know he's definitely excited to talk to you, but I'm glad I had you all to myself. I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to mention to people before we head out.
I think that's it. If they go to metamagic.com, they'll find out a lot more. And I really enjoyed talking to you. This was great.
All right. Well, thanks so much. From all of us here at Expanding Minds, keep your minds open.